Hello everyone, I'm AP, and today we will be talking about sharing code through NPM libraries. My guest today is Emily Aro. Emily is an open source developer active in the JavaScript ecosystem. He currently works as a software developer at Vincit, a Finnish software agency. Hello, Emily, and welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So can you tell a little bit about yourself and how you ended up publishing libraries on NPM?
It's been so long that I've been inside effectively open source in one way or another. I was having trouble thinking of this question earlier, of trying to figure out, is there a time really that I wrote code before I ended up actually writing open source? It must be there, but it's somewhere like when I was in high school, pretty much, maybe university a little bit. But no, I'm one of those people that writes code for fun in the evenings because it's relaxing and a weird way of expressing artistic talent of a weird sort. And I found a very welcoming home for myself in writing quite a few JavaScript libraries, in fact, trying to solve problems at the right sort of level, which is usually three floors down from where you think you ought to be. And that usually means that you're writing tools that someone else is going to use to build their tool that then is going to be used by someone else. And that's actually going to do something that real people get to actually experience. And JavaScript somehow seems to have grabbed me along ever since it's been a thing. I've had a computer with internet access almost ever since the web was a thing, but admittedly, it was only maybe in 1992 that I got the first one. But, you know, a while, been around.
So what sort of libraries have you built?
The biggest small niche in which I've found myself is localization tools for JavaScript in particular. This particular rabbit hole started around 2011, 2012. I needed to get this web app to work in both Finnish and English and Swedish. And then I needed to find a tool to make that happen. And I ended up finding a tool that did sort of logically the thing I wanted it to do, but it did it a little bit inefficiently. So I ended up using that and improving it. And then I improved it a little bit more. And now I'm the main maintainer of Message Format, which is an OpenJS Foundation project. And oops. But that one led to another library, Make-Plural, which is it's used by Message Format and a few others, which that one takes the plural rule definitions that I expressed in the Unicode CLDR, the Common Language Data Repository, and it's a tool that takes how those rules for how pluralization works in different languages are encoded, and it translates those to JavaScript. So I've got this weird chain there of using one tool in order to translate from one source code into JavaScript, and then Message Format is taking this in part, and then another part is Message Format, that the messages which are expressed in a kind of language itself, and transpiling both of these into yet more JavaScript, and that goes into something like Babel, and that then gets transpiled into yet more JavaScript, and that one actually ends up in browsers and in other environments.
And all this tooling exists to enable it to you to easier
to make it easier for you to write an interface where you don't have to say count of new messages one, so but you can say you have one new message rather than one new messages, because pluralization rules are difficult. And other cases, that's maybe the simplest way of explaining it. In English, it's really quite easy, but there are plenty of languages around the world where the rules for this are far more complicated. That particular rabbit hole also led me to configuration file format. And there I've written supporting libraries for a couple of different languages. Dot properties is one, but the biggest one at the moment is YAML, which I was intending to use that in order to build a thing for message format file support, but that never happened because of another long story. But I ended up with YAML being a library that essentially has the best support for YAML of all the implementations currently out there. I think it broke a little bit over 10 million weekly downloads on NPM recently. So that's kind of cool.
Wow, that's quite a bit. I think YAML, a lot of people have a lot of emotions. That there are 10 million downloads of a YAML library in the JavaScript ecosystem is almost breaking news to me.
This is the second largest YAML library in terms of usage at the moment.
Okay.
So there's plenty of it. It's amusing to also see that because there's this push against YAML in some certain circumstances, it's amusing to see that they're using the tooling to make people be able to avoid YAML. Some of it is using my library in order to enable them to do that. But it's this continuous series of rabbit holes of finding an interesting problem and trying to solve that, and then discovering there's a deeper problem and, oh, better solve that too. And then you just go and go and go and go. And then you end up on like multiple different specification workshops that are doing things that are beyond the code. So you know, improving the whole specification behind it. But yeah, that's one does.
So you've spent a lot of time building like open source tools. And just before we go to like, you know, actually NPM cases and like how all this relates to a normal front-end developer's work, I'm curious, what do you feel that, you know, building these libraries has given you professionally?
My profession? I mean, literally. Most of my life, I've been trying to avoid ending up doing web programming as my work, because I always figured, you know, I've always got that, but try and focus on something else. But I keep on. Maybe it's time to admit that, you know, this is what I'm actually the happiest at doing. But no, doing all this and doing really a lot of time spending within code is a huge part of what I think has been able to give me the profession that I currently have and the professional career I've been able to maintain.
Yeah. I think you just throw a number like 10 million weekly downloads out in the air, but I think that's like a huge impact that you can have that you couldn't have, you know, just by... Or at least you can have it in a very few places when working that you can affect the lives of, you know, millions of people. And I think because of that, like building open source tools and like being able to share that code through NPM is almost like a superpower. Like even if you wouldn't be working at a company that has a huge impact, being able to share your code with other people enables you to contribute in the global open source community.
Absolutely. It is important for me to know that at least a little part, hopefully not just a little part, but some part of what I do is actively making the world a little bit of a better place in some obscure, weird way, but still.
Then going towards like more like business use cases, like if I think about NPM and sharing libraries from my professional perspective, the first place where I had to face the fact that I should be publishing NPM libraries was when an organization that I worked had multiple teams and projects. And you notice that people, because we don't have an efficient way of sharing code, even though NPM exists, but you know, people are lazy, or you know, there is just a barrier for you to use it. So people end up, including myself, copy pasting, you know, code between projects because you know it's just one file and stuff like that. And at some point you start feeling that is very stupid because you know those files do not stay in sync. You have to, you know, copy paste bug fixes or update things, and no one remembers to do it. For example, at my current company, my colleague James just published an ESLint configuration that we should use across projects. It's still a work in progress, but like that's a good example that you know no one remembers to copy paste the company ESLint, you know, every now and then unless someone reminds them. So using a library for this kind of stuff is very effective, and it enables you to improve the copy paste code across, you know,
not copy paste code.
Yeah, but like the code that used to be copy paste code, people can come together and improve it together. So if someone fixes a bug, it gets fixed everywhere at some point and stuff like that. So
yes, and it also has it provides a centralized repository where you know that this is the thing that you're actually talking about, rather than this thing that I copied from someone else and then slightly modified and then passed it on. And then it becomes difficult to really see what is the original, what is the purpose of this, and oh, good grief, where's the documentation for it?
Yeah, well, that's like, I think, a very undervalued part of code. That is, you know, when you create a shared library, you have to build a good documentation because it forces you to do it because it's an individual library somewhere. So you start feeling like they should have an explanation on it.
And it's not just that you start feeling like it should, but it really, really should, because that's one of the biggest fundamental points of being able to package things into modules and libraries and so on. So you can black box them later. So you can just later look at the documentation, look at how this thing is supposed to work, and then use it according to those instructions, rather than needing to read through all of the code. Okay, you end up doing that sometimes in any case, but you don't kind of have to. So you have that interface between the human and the computer. And so the human can end up imagining and thinking how the whole big system works without understanding every single line of it the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's discuss a little bit about the common pitfalls that you might end up, because you have experience with building libraries at scale. But I think doing this even within a single organization is not very easy. So I think we could discuss a little bit about this. So let's say I've now decided, okay, I want to stop this stupid copy-pasting stuff. I want to build a library that can be used across the teams in my company. And then I decide that, okay, I will just publish it into an NPM. What are the common pitfalls or, you know, best practices, you know, you end up either not following in the beginning, so they become pitfalls that you have to fix. But, you know, like what's involved in this process when I want to share NPM libraries with other people?
First step, especially coming from that sort of a context, is figuring out what is really the right venue for publishing the library and what is the licensing that is the right licensing to apply to it. Because effectively, if you're publishing something that is not entirely your own, you kind of do need to get someone else to put a stamp on saying, you know, it's okay to publish this, or that it's okay to publish this in our own private NPM registry rather than the whole global public one, because it can be hugely useful for a company or any sort of organization that does have internal tooling like that to be able to share internally some of the libraries that they are using and to have those just as easily accessible as any other libraries. But then if you can, then yes, I would very much encourage you to get your code out into the big, wide, scary public. And if possible, attach a license to it that allows other people to use it as well. I mean, because it is technically entirely possible for you to publish something on NPM and not actually give people a license to using it. Whether this makes sense, probably not, but it's possible. So that's like step one. Figure out that you can, that no one's going to, that you're not going to get fired, for instance, for doing the thing that is the useful thing to do. Self-preservation. It's somewhere.
I think there's like two aspects to that. The first is the aspect of an individual developer. And I think from the perspective of an individual developer, that is something that a lot of people may not think through. But if you can get your employer to give you permission to publish something on NPM with an open source license, it actually is something that you give it to the community, but you actually get it also to yourself. Because if you don't open source it, once you switch companies, you no longer can use the code. And no one will know that you've done something, you know, a good or a bad, but, you know, you've done a library, hopefully.
You've done a thing, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, no one will see that. So I think from a perspective of an individual developer, there is this incentive that, you know, you should try to have this discussion. And from my perspective, I feel that a lot of companies are quite positive, you know, they don't, like, there are not a lot of hurdles if it is really a separate library that is not, you know, it's not application code. And so I would say that the barrier might be lower than people expect. At least that's worth asking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had actually relatively good success at the different companies and corporations for which I've done work to be able to package some of the things that I've done for them or that we've done for them into libraries on NPM or work that effectively improves an already open source library. And some of it I've ended up, because everyone wanted to, publishing entirely in my own name, and some of it has gone under the name of the client. And really, I mean, one of the biggest benefits here is that, one, you don't really lose anything. Nobody loses anything. Because for the sorts of tooling that it does make sense to publish on NPM, it's really, really unlikely that that's actually business critical for whoever is running that company. So having anything like that be public is really actually perfectly fine. And the other thing is that it's a wonderful tool if you can use that for recruitment material. If you can point at something, if you are a company that is interested in that is doing anything that is worth having published as a library, you're probably interested in having good developers. And if said good developers can find online the sort of quality of code that you are providing to the world already, free of charge or however you want to present it, it's a really good selling point for recruitment. Plus, of course, the individual benefits that you mentioned as well. But all I wanted to say is not just the personal benefits here. Everyone really can benefit. Not to mention the fact that if you're publishing something in the public, you're going to take much better care about the documentation because you're going to be afraid of, oh, good grief, someone's going to see it. I need to make this actually be good. And this will improve your own life in the long run. Because good documentation is always better than what you think you've got, which is probably not enough.
And you know, actually, Mark Delglish mentioned this in a past episode of this podcast, where he explained how this sort of non-code work, documentation, making marketing sites, is something that he actually values very much because it changes your perspective on what you're doing. It forces you to lay out, you know, the philosophy or, you know, the architecture or whatever you're building. You have to explain it to someone else. And actually, that is a very good learning process because you need to kind of, why am I solving this problem in this way that I'm solving it. That has to be answered in order for someone to use your thingy. So it's not like an only an additional burden, but it's more like the whole productization process of an open source library gives you a lot of, you know, experience, and it helps you grow as a developer too.
Absolutely. It's different experience. And because it's open source, and to some extent, one of the reasons why I like writing open source is that I don't need to care about that if I don't want to. As in, I don't... Yes, if I write a really cool, something that I think is really useful, it's nice to be able to present it and document it. Okay, the documentation is a side one, but market it. The marketing there is the thing. You don't need to do that if you don't want to.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, marketing helps, even if what you're selling has zero cost, because it's competing for attention.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So now let's we're now in the situation where we know the license. So we either, cool, you know, it will be open source, or we will distribute it internally. So what are the, you know, can I just, you know, push a button and it will work? Or what should I kind of expect, and how should I approach it?
It's yes, but no, but yes. That doesn't help any, but really, it's really, really, I mean, the technical task for publishing a library on NPM is like ridiculously simple. You can do, I think, practically all of it on the command line. And when you get to it, the actual act of writing NPM publish in a package is almost a letdown, because it's so anticlimactic, because it just sort of happens and it takes like a couple of seconds, done. And there's no big ta-da, hurrah, whatever. No, it's just done. But of course, getting that to be a good library and to be really useful and efficient and other adjectives is more work. It used to be simpler. And really okay. So the world has gotten more complicated, as it always does. And for JavaScript libraries, you've got to think right now mainly of about three different sorts of environments, different sorts of users for your code. And these three have effectively different sorts of requirements. And they're all interrelated, of course. You've got Node.js, which is running on the server side, and it's, you know, where you actually do most of the operations on the code, transpiling and so on. But it's still itself a very, very large target that you need to keep in mind. Yes, we're talking technically about front-end libraries here, but many of the tools that are useful in the front-end are all also useful in the back-end. Node.js, and having code that libraries that work really well both on the front end and on the back end, that's not quite holy grail, but you know, that's the tricky bit. Then for the front end, right now we're living in a world where almost all of the code that you end up experiencing having run in your browser, in the client, is coming there through some bundler. So you've got something like Webpack or Rollup or Parcel packaging some source and then transpiling, doing things to it, bundling it, and then that's actually what's being deployed to run in browsers. That how the bundlers and how Node.js like to get their code, and what's good for one isn't necessarily always good for the other. So you got to balance these. The third is testing frameworks, because you've got Jest and Mocha and some others as well that you have to account for, because they do their own things regarding how they load code. When you do a require or an import in Jest and Mocha and others, they do slightly different operations to it than other systems. They try to get everything to work just as it would otherwise, but it's still the difference is once you get deep enough, you will encounter those differences and it will be vexing. So keeping these in mind is important. Then you got to keep in mind for all of this, are you going to publish it effectively as a common JS modules or as ES modules or a mix of the two or like both? And are you going to be providing more than one different really version of the entire library in the package that you're publishing? Because you can do that these days. Whether it makes sense, that's a different question. But it's possible to provide different sorts of targets, different endpoints for different targets, depending on who's the consumer for that library.
So
getting that to be right is
elaborate. Tricky. CommonJS is when you call require.
Yes.
And then ESM is import syntax.
Yes. There's a movement that we're in the middle of for having eventually almost all code be primarily ES modules, but it's taking years and it will continue to take years for this transition to really happen. And this is what's effectively making, okay, it's one of the reasons, which is making front-end module publishing right now a little bit tricky because if you want to care about it, you can. And if you want to really care about it, you can. And then you hit the corner cases that are not necessarily all really well accounted for in all cases. And then you learn.
So if we then go, what is the simplest configuration? Like, you mentioned these three targets. So I would then, like from my own experience, say that if you stick to one testing library in your like let's talk about this use case when you're first and foremost publishing for a your own use or your own organization's use. So there you can make your life simpler if you're able to use just Jest or Mocha. Okay, yes. That's simply testing. And then if you're using a a bundler like Webpack. Can you just publish CommonJS? Will that work in all front-end applications?
So what you've got to keep in mind is that when you're publishing something on NPM, you're publishing something that is going to be consumed by somebody else who's going to put that into their bundler, effectively.
If we stick to the case where I'm going to support only my own consumers at first.
Then it becomes interesting. It's an optimization question. So if you want stuff to just work and be simple, it is still an entirely valid thing to right now be publishing your code entirely and only in CommonJS. You should probably only use named exports coming out of your stuff because as you're likely writing your code, the original source as ES, using import and export and so on nowadays, but then you're transpiling that to CommonJS, then exactly the shape of how that output looks like it matters.
Okay, so if I want to keep it simple, I use only named exports.
Yeah.
So there's one simplification. So one test framework, CommonJS, and only named exports. So now I've at least gotten rid of some of the corner cases.
Sure, yeah. You're not covering all of the corner cases, but you've gotten rid of some of them. My current recommendation is that if you can get away with it, publish as ES modules only.
Okay.
But this does mean that you need to actually document that and you need to make sure that what you're doing makes sense being published as ES modules only and is getting consumed by an audience that understands these limitations. So for if you're targeting front-end stuff only, then it's pretty easy because all of the parcel, rollup, webcam, pack, all of them relatively easily handle ES modules, even if they're coming from via NPM. And Jest and Mocha have decent and improving support for those. And these are going to help tremendously with the tree shaking of the code going forward.
And that's actually a very good point. So if I publish, say, a common JS module,
the tree shaking is not going to be as effective. And for front-end stuff, there's a slight code size penalty per file or per module of what you're publishing, because the bundlers end up needing to add a little bit more wrapper code around common JS files than they need to add around ES modules. This is sometimes relevant, sometimes not relevant. I've got code that I've published as ES only. I've got code that I've published as both common JS and ES modules. And I've got code that I'm publishing only as CommonJS. Because sometimes you can figure out that really the savings that you might get from CommonJS are so minuscule they don't really count. And sometimes, like for make plural, the way that it's ended up structured, the savings are like 20 times the file size, depending on the format, because of the way that tree shaking ends up working.
Super interesting. And then I think, like, I'm a TypeScript user. And one thing I encountered when we were publishing our design system was that you need to somehow publish the types. So there is in the TypeScript compiler, you can have a flag that will emit a types.d or index.d.ts file, but you know, typings file, and then you can reference that in the package JSON to get the types to the consumers.
Yeah, you don't, especially if you've got multiple endpoints for your library, then it becomes easier if you just put the .d.ts files next to the .js files that are forming the endpoints there.
Okay.
If you're using the exports in order to alter some of the paths of where those imports are really coming from, then you need to do actually testing and make sure that everything's working in the consumers of that library from the TypeScript typing point of view.
Okay. So now I have my happy path succeeding, and then I want to distribute the code. So I run npm publish.
Before you run your npm publish, npm has another nice command line command called npm pack.
Okay.
And that's going to create a tarball.tar.gs file that looks that effectively contains the stuff that your library will contain once it's installed, once it's published. And in particular, when you're getting used to starting this, that provides a really nice way of you producing this one file that has effectively your library in it. And then you can write a different application or something. And in there, npm install that .tar.gs gz file, and then have it like do the actual install all of the dependencies of it and work as if someone were installing it from npm. And you get to do this and find out that, oops, you missed this part in your files list and your library doesn't actually include half the code it's supposed to have before you publish it.
So you can use npm pack to simulate the publishing process on your local environment.
Yes, you can get a good approximation of what is the result of the publishing.
Good, yeah.
It's not going to run the pre-publish only script if you've got that defined, but you can run that manually and then run npm pack and then see locally that what you've got is what you think you ought to have.
Okay, so now I have a working library that when I when I write npm publish, it goes to the npm
the cloud.
It goes to the cloud. Yeah, it goes to the cloud, exactly. And if it's like, if it's not a private package, you know, it can be accessed by everyone. I can publish it to the public npm repository, and that happens by I need an account there, so I need to sign up and, you know, do that jazz and log in or something. But then there's the case of if the package is private. So we've distributed our packages through GitHub packages, which is a very simple tool if you are using GitHub. But there are a couple of things when you try to consume them through a private repository that is different from a public one. Have you done this? Do you have?
Most of my experience with this is with stuff going through a JFrog Artifactory, providing a local or private NPM registry. And there, the really the sensible thing to do is to have that private registry be the single, be configured so that you can use that as a local cache for the public big NPM. So all of the requests go through that. And some specified namespace that you're using for your private packages is then hosted specifically from there. So from the point of view of the users within that organization, all they need to do is configure the NPM client that they know that either all requests need to go through this single registry, or some specific namespace needs to go through this private registry, and have that just work.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very similar with GitHub packages. And I think that the few things that they're not tricky, but there are something that you need to set up there is the authentication. Like in their local computers, the people need a token. And then also when you run continuous integration, you need an authentication token there, like on Jenkins or similar. So that's something that, you know, you just need to do. But I think one interesting aspect of building libraries is maintaining different versions. So let's discuss shortly. Like, you know, I encounter tweets like maybe at least once a month in Twitter where someone is like, "Semware is shit." Sorry, this is
probably they're wrong. Crazy. They're wrong.
But you know, like, what are the what are the pro tips for, you know, maintaining libraries when you have breaking changes and stuff like that? Like, you know, from your perspective, how does it work?
First, use Semver and follow Semver, and don't be too afraid of major version updates. They will need to happen at some point. Effectively, it's a marker of you realizing that you're doing good work, and there's fundamentally something that you did earlier that needs to be improved to be doing later. It's good to bunch them up so that you don't end up at, you know, version 12 right away, but it takes you time to get there. Right now, for instance, I'm working on message format version 3 and YAML version 2, and both of those have been in pre-release stage now for at least a couple of months each. So there's a bunch of things happening in both of those, and both of those are, all of those changes are sort of getting packaged into the new big, new major release. For many cases, though, it becomes much easier if you don't need to think about the versioning at the point in time when you're doing the publication, but when you're doing the actual work of what's changing. And one particular tool that I would encourage looking into is the conventional commits specification. So this is the simple version of this is that every single commit that ends up on the release branch has a prefix in the title of the Git commit, like fix colon space or feat colon space or something like this, that is indicating the level of change that this commit is applying to the whole of the package, the repository or whatever. And then what this allows is it makes the Git commits effectively provide metadata about what's really happening when you're doing a release. And there's tooling. Standard version is the standard dash version on NPM is the tool that I most commonly use for this, that will then, when you want to do a version, it will read through your Git commit history from the last time you did a release and it will calculate what is the appropriate Semver, is it patch, minor, or major bump that you really ought to be applying, and it will generate, it will calculate what the next version is, and it will update your change log for you so you don't have to.
So, that's
moving the decision point somewhere else, and it's bringing in automation that makes it more likely that your change log, first of all, will actually get updated.
that's a good point. So now, if I'm a front-end developer, I want to learn how this thing works. What's a good way to get started? How can you practice?
Doing it, like literally start writing code. Start fixing the problem that you've got for which you want a solution. If you don't really have any problem that needs this as a solution, you do. You just haven't identified it yet. So I would highly recommend, actually, rather than spending a lot of time reading, you learn a lot more by making mistakes.
I actually think, I got this from you. I think the best way to practice publishing to NPM I know of is actually publishing your own NPM card. And I'll post the instructions on the show notes. But the basic idea is that you can build a package, and when anyone runs npx your package name, it will print out a card that has your name and your GitHub and Twitter and whatever. So it's cool that you can have your own package with your own username, and then when you write npx ap koponen or npx
Emily,
you get your, for me, that was the first time when I really forced myself into publishing something. So you get cool to do these small things, and you only have a single consumer, like it's only me. And it actually, and if we talk about the different, you have the test framework, and you have the browser and the Node.js. Well, it only runs in that terminal, so you don't have to worry about anything else but Node. So it's a good exercise from my perspective, and I think it's worthwhile because my experience in life is that a lot of the good things that you could do, you won't do because if you don't have this at least the small intuition, like how would I do this? When you're busy, which you usually are when you're working, you don't take the time. But if you do this sort of a small exercise that helps you get the kind of the most of the issues that you feel that there are away, then it becomes easier to kind of feel in your normal work life that, hey, maybe I should publish this. And maybe, it's not as hard. I've done it before. So it takes those barriers down. So that's the easiest way. I think then building your own small library, well, you've built small and big libraries your whole life almost. I've published a few Tailwind related. I think it's useful if you find a niche, like something that doesn't yet have a lot of, things going on. It's easy to contribute something that might even be interesting to someone else. My pro tip, for publishing libraries, is that do something that is, or if you have good, great visions on the next state management library for React, go for it. we only have 100, but we might need another one.
That doesn't mean that there's that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, sure.
I mean literally, because that is a field where if you start getting actually into it, you need to always keep in mind that when you're writing something like this, when you're doing work like this, there is one target of the actual technical library that you're working on. But a really, really important thing that you're doing is improving yourself from this experience. And if you start looking at React State Management as a thing where you are writing a tool that does all the things, that is a wonderful mental state in which you can then go and look at how Redux actually works, how MobX actually works, how these other competitors have solved the problems that you want to solve. You want to do it better, of course. But if you go look at their source code, you can now then see it at, in a different sort of perspective. And that's going to make you a much better developer, a much better thinker in many ways later on. It might lead to something, it might not, but always keep in mind that by no means are you only writing code for that library. You're writing code to improve yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes that works for me. Like, this is my personal experience. But to be honest, I personally don't have enough personal curiosity, like, to build something that I don't feel that, you know, has an impact. The close thing that would be to, for me, would be to find an existing smaller open source project that needs help. So you get to, that is related to something that I want to learn about. So you know, by maintaining, asking issues, helping someone out with a library, that is something that I feel that it combines, the way my brain works. I get the motivation that this is actually used by someone, but at the same time, I get the benefit of, you know, learning something on the topic that I'm interested in.
Absolutely. There's a lot of very, very differently sized projects out there. There's the highly personal stuff that might never have more than really one user, and they even only for a short while. There's the small projects that get updated every once a couple of years, but are still incredibly relevant when you had encountered this specific issue that library is solving. And then there's this whole scale of things, and then you've got stuff like React at Node.js itself at the other end of it, where it's by no means any individual that is producing that work, but it is a community, and where the activity is then quite different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point, because if you think that, you know, oh, I'm such a great front-end developer that only React.
Of course you are. Of course you are.
Yes, only the React main repo, you know, it deserves my greatness. you might end up facing a lot of challenges that you know that are not beneficial in a sense, because you need to take into consideration the community and everything around it. So starting with a smaller library that is maintained by a single individual or a few people might be, you know, a very good. And there is actually a tool, I think, that gives you first good issue tags in GitHub. So I'll put it to the show notes if someone is interested in getting started with their open source work. And the last question, which is no longer about NPM packages, what resources would you recommend to a front-end developer who wants to go from good to great?
Pick a tool, a library, anything, an application that is open source and that you think is good, that provides good documentation that you can actually read, and read through the code, figure out how it's really put internally together. Don't think I've ever read an entire book on anything programming. Okay, I did, you know, university stuff and so on, but that doesn't really count. But I've learned so much more through reading other people's code, reading and learning and seeing how things can be put together, and getting an understanding from that of the whole width of scope that is really possible here, the different ways that you can modularize any sorts of tooling, and the different sorts of results and limitations that this produces. And then pick another, maybe a third, keep on going. Realize when you're doing all of this that you start to see how these things could be improved a bit. Let's submit the PR. It'll get denied, probably. But, you know, it's like what you said earlier. Doing things for the first time is really tough. Doing things for the 10th or the 20th times becomes really easy. And if you never start, you never get there. So start.
That's a good advice. Actually, we've talked about this at work. Some people don't like online courses. Books don't, you know, work. They like to learn by doing. I think it's also good for imposter syndrome, because I've, you know, there are some very popular libraries that are magnificent in every way. But it's good for your over-engineering tendencies if you have those. When you see that how effectively things can be solved with very simple techniques. So you learn a lot. Yeah, I love that recommendation. And I also love it because hopefully it will also touch my life because someone is improving open source somewhere out there, which then ends up being the 26th dependency of an NPM package that I'm using. So, so it's good for all of us.
If you're at 26 dependencies, then you'd better have good reasons for adding that many.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Emily. And thanks to all our listeners. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks.